You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Hey, folks, before we get started here, I have a brand new book coming out tomorrow, February 7th. It's called Curveball, When Your Faith Takes Turns You Didn't See Coming. I'm very excited about it. It's the most personal book that I've written, and it's about how my theology changed because of certain experiences that I've had.
Knowing your story, I'm excited for people to hear a little bit more about this move that I think this journey we've both been on to how do we talk about God and engage with these ideas in a more personal way outside of the structure of maybe the way we've always been taught to interpret right. certain experiences and life and how life will throw us curveballs. And yet we can still engage in this life of faith. And mm-hmm. I think that's where a lot of people are.
I think where everybody is at some level or not, our experiences do affect how we think about the nature of God, or if you're Christian, you know, Jesus and Christianity and the Bible and all that. And so this book is about me reflecting on those things, some of which are personal, but some things are like scientific, you know, mm-hmm. just all those things have made me think differently about God. And I'm very conscious about that transition, let's call it, in this book. And so I'm hoping that I'm not telling other people what to believe, you know,
right.
you don't have to have these experiences.
Given the way you're approaching things, that would be to undermine the point,
right,
which is
exactly
your
right.
experiences right. affect how you see the world.
Right. Yeah. And other people can relate in the fact that I think they also have, they think differently about God today than they did 10 years ago, because stuff happened.
Right.
Right. And that's the thing. Stuff happens all the time. And how can it not affect how we think about God?
Absolutely.
That's my point.
You can buy Curveball wherever you like to get your books. If you like to find local bookstores to support, you can go to indiebound.org. I often use bookshop.org as well. But wherever you buy books, the key is just buy the book.
Or several copies.
That's several copies.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely.
You might want to read it more than once. So,
yeah. You know. I think Valentine's Day is coming up.
Is it?
Yeah. So
do people give books on Valentine's Day?
They should.
They should.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Dag nabbit. Yeah.
All right. So pick it up. Curveball.
And
we're really excited because this year we're putting on a class every single month.
Oh my goodness gracious. And our February class is called Putting the Pieces Together After Deconstruction. And it's led by yours truly, by which I mean Jared and myself.
That's right. Yours truly's. I don't know how you pluralize
yours
truly's.
I know we shouldn't even.
Well, bother. The class is live for one night only, and it's going to be on February 20th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern time.
And folks, as we always do, as is our habit, the class is pay what you can until the 20th, and then it'll be available for download for $25.
Alternatively, you can become a member of the Society of Normal People for $12 a month. You'll get access to all of our classes, past, present, future, and you'll get an exclusive members-only Q&A session that we're adding to each class as well.
So if you're stoked about this, and of course you are, for more information and to enroll in the class, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/deconstruction.
See you there, folks. Welcome, everyone, to the inaugural episode of the 7th season of The Bible for Normal People.
Ooh, right.
Today, we are talking about pushing back against biblical womanhood with none other than Beth Allison Barr.
Yeah, and Beth, of course, she's very well known. She teaches European history and all sorts of things like that. She's also got a best-selling book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, which is probably how you heard of her. And it was just so much fun to talk with her and just learning a lot over this episode. So we really hope you enjoy it.
Biblical womanhood is rooted in culture, not actually in the Bible. And so I think this is part of this embattled identity that we are protecting the Bible and protecting the right interpretation of the Bible without realizing that that right interpretation is grounded in a cultural interpretation.
Oh. Ah, da ist meine Prime-Bestellung.
Was? Jetzt schon?
Nur eine Sache begeistert so wie die schnelle Lieferung mit Prime. Und zwar das tolle Unterhaltungsangebot von Prime.
Was schauen wir uns an?
Fallout ist zurück mit Staffel 2. Unsere Lieblingshelden kämpfen sich durch die brutale und bizarre Einöde, um dahin zu gelangen, wo alles begann. New Vegas.
Schnelle, kostenlose Lieferung, geniale Unterhaltung und mehr gibt's bei Prime. Für nur 8,99 Euro pro Monat. Werde jetzt Prime-Mitglied. Die Inhalte können Werbung enthalten. Fortlaufende Mitgliedschaft. Mehr auf amazon.de/prime.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knitter ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Lebara ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 GB für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd. Lebara, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
Thanks for jumping on the podcast with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Where did this view of womanhood come from and why did it develop? We have the same Bible, and yet it developed within evangelicalism in a very different way than it did for mainline Protestants and progressive denominations. So what were those influences that changed from one to the other? How do we get to a different result?
So I might push back a little bit on difference between mainline and evangelicalism, because even though mainlines have been ordaining women for quite some time, if you actually look at the numbers of how many women are in the pastorate or are, you know, what you would call senior pastors, whatever, they're still really small. Right. And so it's fascinating how even within structures that support women in ministry, women are not being supported in a way that helps promote them through. So we have a leaky pipeline, even in mainline.
Yes, it may be true in theory, but not true in practice.
Right. So I think in some way, so there are significant differences between evangelicalism and mainline. But at the same time, the reality for both is we see women not moving through to these positions of authority.
Could we talk about the differences that you just mentioned between evangelical and mainline churches?
Yeah, certainly. So the mainline churches that I'm most familiar with, of course, are American Baptist, with the Baptist world. And we know that American Baptists have been ordaining women since the late 19th century. In fact, almost all, we know that, you know, Methodists also claim that women began to be ordained in the 19th century. And in fact, we see throughout, you know, Catherine Breckus has done this wonderful study where she's counted women in North America in the 18th and the 19th century, and she's counted more than 100 of these women who are preachers and ordained. So we know that in the 19th century, we have this significant tradition of women preaching. And this tradition seems to continue more in mainline churches than it does in evangelicalism. In evangelicalism, it goes backwards, whereas in mainline churches, it's sort of a stuttered going forward. We see women being ordained in the 19th century, and then that kind of goes away for a little bit in the early 20th century, and then we see it pick back up again in the post-war era, especially. And we see women being ordained and recognized at full equality. I think theologically, one of the main differences is that mainline churches emphasize that women and men are equally made in the image of God. And this is consistent if you look through, you know, almost all of their statements when they talk about why they ordain women. They often start with that. And they start with Galatians as well, with emphasizing that Paul said that there is no male or female, there is no slave or free. And so those we see prominently focused in traditions that ordain women. And in evangelical traditions, what we see emphasized is on the order of the household and the order of the church, this very much this emphasis on order and that God is a God of order. That's something that you hear frequently. And that the order, so instead of maybe focusing on, you know, we are all one in Christ Jesus, as we find in Galatians, they focus on other passages that emphasize hierarchy, such as what they pull from the household codes from, you know, Ephesians 5, of course, is the one we often think about. So what I think one of the main differences is we see a different focus on biblical texts. Mainline churches focus on ones that demonstrate the equality of men and women, and that we are all called and in the same ministry. And evangelical churches focus more on passages that emphasize the differences, or emphasize what they perceive to be a difference between women and men, and that God has ordained an order for the house, for the church, and for broader society. So
that's interesting. I don't know if I've thought through it
quite that way
long enough in the way that you've just said it, which is behind the differences, because certainly, you know, we hear about the differences, but behind that, I hear you saying there's a structure or a preference, a tendency toward a God of order, that there is a certain structure to it. And so that is the impetus that manifests in these differences between men and women. And what biblical womanhood really comes from is this desire to see structure and order. And the reason that's so interesting to me is because as of late, I've been hearing about the Republican Party being a party of law and order. And so there's this connection of a desire to see order. And so the political and religious affiliations between, you know, conservative Republicans and evangelicals make sense if that's the underlying structure. Is that what you've seen as well?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's the underlying structure, but I would say it's a underlying difference, this emphasis on that God has created a particular order. And that if you step outside of that order, then that is what leads to the fall of nations. That's what leads to the fall of your household, et cetera. There are certainly, you know, if you think about, you know, this is something that Kristen Dumais wrote in Jesus and John Wayne about how this fringe ideas that we thought were fringe, like Bill Gothard. And one of the things that the Bill Gothard movement emphasized was on how God would bless the homes and the nations, you know, et cetera, that stayed within the design. And the design was male headship and female submission. And that if you went outside of those bounds, then that would lead to chaos in your family. And those really became mainstream ideas. You know, I think focus on the family was a big part of bringing those ideas more mainstream. I think the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, there was a lot of emphasis on or use of these Gothard ideas. So I think this emphasis on order and that there is a right order for things to be done. And in fact, I mean, Al Mohler just very recently said this. He said that, you know, what biblical womanhood is a rightful ordering of church and home. And I've quoted him on that more than once, which is why I remember it.
I'll bet you have.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn. Und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Well, let me ask here, and I hope this is, I want to go a little bit behind what you're observing here.
Yeah.
Because I want to try to understand this. It's one thing to say that there are differences in what is emphasized in the Bible, mm-hmm. whether it's image of God or hierarchy, order, that kind of stuff. But behind that, there's still something going on, I think, that drives people to highlight certain passages over others. So I don't know, can you help us, like, maybe even how's this sausage made? What's even behind that, if anything?
Well, of course, the main thesis of the making of biblical womanhood is that biblical womanhood is rooted in culture, not actually in the Bible. And so I would say a big driving factor is our culture that it stems. If you think about Southern white culture, which is in some ways how women are regarded in Southern white culture, is pretty much the same as what has become known as biblical womanhood. And this is something that we can trace back, you know, very clearly to the 19th century, these markers of piety, purity, submission, and domesticity, which is what, you know, this cult of white Southern womanhood was supposed to be. And this has become what biblical womanhood is. So I think a lot of it, I mean, it really is rooted in this white Southern culture. You could think about post-Civil War, where the emancipation of the slaves, and there's a great concern for order. And sort of, you know, I have a historian friend who always says when they couldn't oppress Black people, they oppressed women. And it's not quite as simple as that. But we do see this hierarchy being more strictly established in the post-Civil War era. And when we see challenges to this white Southern culture is when we often see these more restrictive pushbacks within the church. So I'll give you two examples. First one, suffrage. And in the late 19th century, we see the emergence of suffrage. And Beverly Gaventa, who I just love Beverly Gaventa. And one thing that I heard her say once that has always stuck with me was that she suspects that, you know, she said, somebody needs to do the work. And I've done a little bit of the work and she seems to be right. We need to do more. But it seems to be that the emphasis on using passages in the New Testament that seem to suggest the submission of women and male headship, these texts of terror, as we call them, Phyllis Trible, that they begin to be focused on significantly when women begin to push for the right to vote. And that does seem to be a pretty clear correlation. This also correlates with Junia. Junia, of course, in Romans 16:7, who's identified as an apostle. And we begin to see her being identified instead of as female, as male. And this does seem to correspond in biblical translations with, you know, around the suffrage movement. And so there seems to be this clear, like going back to the Bible, why can't women have the vote? Because women are told by God that they're supposed to be under male authority. So we see, you know, so that's one example. And a second example that we see similar is in the post-World War II era, and again, in the U.S., where there is a concerted nationwide effort to get women out of jobs that men could have. And this is when we begin to see this, this uptick in emphasis on women's places in the home. Women's place is, you know, the domestic sphere. Men are to be out in public. And this is tied to how God created men and women. And so we see, you know, when we see women moving towards more equality is often when we see these strong sort of pushbacks to right society and put them back in the home.
Well, it's so ironic to hear you talk about this because, you know, I grew up in a tradition, you know, Southern Baptist evangelical, where I was warned about culture and how culture will actually take us off the path. And so to hear, you know, the Southern
white...
Well,
the wrong kind of culture.
Well, there was no acknowledgement, though, that it was culture. It was just what the Bible said. And culture was this accidental thing that will take you off the path. But to hear, you know, this Southern white cultural influence on it, as well as these, you know, historical moments of suffrage and we sort of let the cat out of the bag, women are working, but now they're taking men's jobs. How do you assess then the relationship between the Bible and the even, you know, I hear you saying is it's not so much the Bible, it's culture, but does the Bible promote the kind of womanhood we see even in evangelicalism or not, or is it ambiguous? How do we assess that?
So I would say the Bible used by most evangelicals does promote it because most evangelicals are using English Bible translations. And many of those English Bible translations that they are using are ones that tend to obscure women within the text. And of course, a prominent example of this is the English Standard Version, the ESV. Take, for example, in Timothy, where it talks about the qualifications to be, you know, various elder in the church. that has all, you know, it's translated in the ESV as having all male pronouns. And yet we know that that's not an accurate reflection. It's more complicated than that. So I would say that most white evangelicals in these conservative traditions that support male headship and female submission also use corresponding biblical translations that also seem to support that. So I would argue that part of it is the translation history and a lack of knowledge about how much translations are influenced by the culture of the translators. There's a lot of fear about that. People are afraid that if they admit that there is influence on the translation of the Bible, then that somehow invalidates Christianity. And I think that fear is also cultural, that evangelical culture in some ways has always been defined by who they are against rather than, you know, who they are for. We're keeping the bad guys out. We're protecting mm-hmm. the family, protecting the children. And so I think this is part of this embattled identity that we are protecting the Bible and protecting the right interpretation of the Bible without realizing that that right interpretation is grounded in a cultural interpretation.
Yeah.
And they're afraid to see that.
And we're very much, of course, in that mess right now. You know, there's no question about that. A side note, you mentioned the ESV. Mark Strauss, who is a New Testament scholar, he wrote an article years ago when the ESV came out, something like, why the English Standard Version should not be the standard English version.
Uh-huh.
Clever talk. Anyway, but it's just... Yeah, I think people recognize the problems with this translation, and maybe it's blind spots, but
it's everywhere though. Yeah. Everywhere. I was horrified. I was in the UK for the first time since COVID last April, and one of my favorite churches in London. It's an old medieval church, and it's now a non-denominational evangelical church. And I went in this time, and every chair in there had an ESV sitting in it. And yeah. I just was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask then, you know, we've jumped from the Bible to kind of modern day, but can you say maybe just briefly, what's the historical evolution of this? You know, there were these moments within suffrage post-World War II where we're emphasizing things, but what, you know, were there other kind of What's the evidence for women, biblical womanhood or women's involvement in church things before that?
Well, and this might also tie into your question about, you know, does the Bible support this? The Bible is patriarchal. It was written in a patriarchal culture. It reflects patriarchal norms. And so when we think about the beginning of what we would call biblical womanhood today, and I would define that the way it is defined, which is that men are called to be leaders and women are called to submit to male leadership. So this is grounded in this broader patriarchy that we do see in biblical text. It's impossible to read the Bible without coming away with how women are marginalized, the difficult situations that women find themselves in, et cetera. So I think on the one hand, we have to recognize that's part of it is the patriarchal world in which the Bible was written, both, you know, all of it was written in a patriarchal world. So that's a big piece of it. But if we think historically, a turning point for what we would consider to be modern biblical womanhood today is the Reformation era. And this is something that, you know, I always say I have to be really careful on because I have a lot of Reformation friends. The 16th century conference is one of the ones that I go to. And so I always have to be very careful about this. I don't want to blame it on Reformation theology, so to speak. But
you can hear if you want to. Go ahead.
I can blame. You know, I mean, it's how Reformation theology was then translated within a world that was already beginning to enforce more laws. Actually, it goes back to this law and order sort of thing, this ordering of society, where we see laws are becoming increasingly hindering women's ability to inherit property and constricting what women can do. And we also see this is when we see Reformation theology becoming entrenched, and with this emphasis on the godly family, you know, this holy household, as Linda Roper calls it, with the emphasis on to be a godly woman is to be a godly wife, at the same time that the laws of the Western world were becoming increasingly restrictive about wives. So if a godly woman is to be a wife, then in the early modern world, a godly woman was to be under the legal authority of a man. And so these two things became, they became a part of the Christian culture, this emphasis on the wife, and that this was a godly woman, and that her place was to be in the home and under male authority. Mm. So that would be a big turning point, would be the Reformation.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung nur 3,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
Well, you know, just maybe a subtext here I want to get at. You seem to like to speak your mind, don't you, Beth? And you get a lot of pushback from this. And, you know, social media is our reality, and it's easy to say, oh, I don't like social media, this and that.
Right, yeah.
But I think we, it's also a window onto certain things. And I know that you've had a lot of difficulty with fielding that. And can you just maybe a couple things, just maybe describe a little bit of that, your own experience, and how, what you hope to get out of that, right? Because there's a lot of polarization going on and people committed to polarization.
Right.
And how can you, like, how do you navigate that? Because I think that's a reality. A lot of people who don't write big books like yours, they still deal with that, right? And so just give us your experience and how that might help people navigate this reality.
Yeah. So, you know, social media is really both a blessing and a curse, just to use a phrase we often do. And it has given voice to so many people who otherwise would not be heard. And I think that is so important and so significant that it's, you know, it's brought up the scholarship of people of color in a way that they, you know, haven't been brought out into spaces where people like me suddenly are reading and realizing what we have been missing. They also give voice, you know, to women who are able to speak out directly against men, who often may hold, you know, hold the authority. And yet women's voices, you know, a good example of this is with Dane Ortlund, just came out in Christianity Today about, you know, a problem that happened in his church. And the woman who claimed that she had been retaliated and fired was able to speak out and to bring her case forward and begin to get some justice for that. And so it's given, and survivors, we can think about the Southern Baptist Convention. We can think about all the survivors. You know, I mean, in fact, a lot of this played out on social media. Megan Lively, whose story helped lead to the firing of Paige Patterson from Southwestern, that actually did play out on social media, where she identified who she was on social media. So I think social media is really helpful.
It's leveling the playing field in some sense, because
it is indeed.
Because the powerful people can't control it.
Right.
Right. So that's what's happening. Okay.
Yeah. And that causes a great deal of concern.
Doesn't it though? Yeah.
you can't control their voices and you don't know what they're going to say. And there's also a lot of, you know, anxiety about social media. Like, who do we listen to? How do I know this is a person I should listen to? How do I know that, you know, why do you say not to listen to this person? There, you know, so I think it's this question of authority, which is interesting because that also stems back to thinking about Reformation theology. Where does biblical authority lie? And so we see, you know, on social media, it's almost a, you know, it's almost a free-for-all in some sense. There's not clear rules. And so that also, that opens the door to this toxic culture and this lack of civil dialogue, civil discourse. And, you know, it also leads to powerful people being able to lash out against people that they disagree with who don't have very many followers and bury them. I think that, you know, something this bullying that happens on Twitter is very real. So I think, you know, it's a hard space to navigate. It's something I was not prepared for. There have been moments that I'm not sure if it's worth it or not to stay out there. But yet what makes it worth it is that your voice can be heard by people who need to hear your voice. And so that's something I think, you know, I see tweets from people who say they feel like they're shouting into the darkness, that nobody's listening to them. And actually, chances are much more likely that somebody is listening to them. And so I think that, you know, this the possibility of connection and of hearing other people is so much greater in the space of social media than it is in sort of just our regular daily interactions where our access to this type of information is much more limited and we might be much more tempted to stay within our own spheres that we know. So our own little echo chambers. So, it's a hard place, but it's also a place that has just transformed so much.
Well, and you've been, again, we have the luxury of getting to talk to you now a couple of years after, actually, I lose track of COVID times. But the, you know, your book's been out for a while and, you know, we get to kind of reflect on your experiences online. Is there anything you said, it's challenging and it's very difficult, but have there been lessons learned? Like you said, there probably are people feeling unheard and wanting to talk about these things and talk about their experiences and do it in a way though, that maybe can avoid some of the pain that you've gone through. Is there any, you know, lessons learned that you can share?
So I think a good lesson, and this is one that I often tell my graduate students, is that public social media means it's public. And so remembering that anything you say can be heard by somebody and picked up and used by somebody. So it doesn't, you know, that's not to scare people from saying things. It's just remembering that the chances are somebody's going to see it. And so that can lead to being more thoughtful about what you say. I think one of the lessons very early on that I learned was that it's very important to admit when you're wrong on Twitter. Things happen so fast. And in some ways, you know, it's like a conversation. And so sometimes you say things in conversations that may not be exactly accurate, or you got some fact confused or something like that. And Twitter actually is a conversation where you can go back and correct that. And I think it's really important that we correct when we either misjudge somebody on Twitter or we make a statement that ends up not being absolutely correct about something. And I think that provides a really good model for others to see people admitting that they're wrong. I think it also, if you get a reputation for doing that, then when people, you know, nitpick your ideas. I mean, I think about, you know, I've been teaching at the college level since the late 90s in grad school. And I think if somebody paid attention to every single word I said over that time, I'd be in a lot of trouble probably, because, you know, and so Twitter pays attention to every word that you say. And so if you develop, if you're always defending yourself and saying, oh, I was always right about this all the time, you know, first of all, that's not true. And secondly, it's going, you know, it leads to that polarization and people not not listening, you know, only people who already agree with you are going to listen to you. So if you want people who don't agree with you to listen to you, then having that posture of, sometimes I am wrong. If I'm wrong, I'm going to tell you I'm wrong. And then we can keep this conversation going forward. And so if you want more people to hear you who may not agree with you, that's a really good posture to take. And I've learned that because, you know, I tell people my audience isn't the people who agree with me. I'm not preaching to the choir. I'm trying to get people who are living in complementarian spaces, and complementarianism is the most recent iteration of male headship, female submission. And so I'm trying to get people in those spaces to hear me. And so it doesn't do me any good to alienate them.
With that, it's a great segue because I wanted, as we come to the end of our time, I wanted to go back to the book and ask, as an academic, what was the purpose for which you wrote the book? Did it accomplish that? Did it surprise you in some ways? Like, what was the intention?
What were you thinking?
Versus the the impact?
So, you know, I didn't intend to write this book. I really never did. This book, I was approached to write this book based on some things, public media things I've been doing. I've since also learned that Kristen Dume pointed some people my way based upon some talks that she'd heard me give. And so when I was asked to write the book, it was this moment where I was distanced enough from what had happened to us, from my husband being fired, that I felt I could talk about it reasonably. I also had a better sense of what had happened. And it was also when the Church Too, Me Too, and, you know, the stuff with Paige Patterson, the SBC was, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention was beginning to have, you know, all of the sex scandal stuff was just beginning to start coming out. And I realized, I was like, you know what? I might be able to help in this situation because I can pull some pieces together that aren't being pulled together and maybe get people to realize that there is a different way to be a faithful Christian and to think about women's roles in the church and in broader society, and to maybe, you know, help speak into this culture that had become so dangerous and toxic for so many women and even men as well. So that's really, you know, I've said before, it took me a while to agree to write it. I was very hesitant. I was afraid to write it. I'm a pretty introverted person. I've become more introverted through this process. You know, I like keep my eyes down when I'm out in public so I don't make eye contact with people. And that's not, you know, it's interesting the impact that it's had on me. But yet at the same time, knowing what I know now, I would have made the decision to write it because it has been incredible watching it change people's lives. And that's just amazing to write something that actually is helping women. Like, I'm going to an ordination on Sunday from a woman who read my book and now is being ordained. That is just incredible to be a part of that. So I'm very thankful that I had the chance to write it, but it is, I had no idea what was going to happen. And it has not been a fun ride.
Yeah. No. Well, can we just, you know, as we come to our conclusion, that last point that you just made, I was at a conference about a month ago and part of a panel. And afterwards, I spoke with a woman who's a scholar. Her field is more biblical studies, but she's writing a book. She's begun sort of pushing it on social media. And she said to me, I am getting some of the most vile things ever said to me. And even a death threat. And it's one thing. I mean, I really applaud you. And I think, you know, we do this too at the Bible for Normal People. We're willing to put up with things, with getting things out there for people who benefit from it. And there is always the block button. You know, you don't have to listen to people's crap. You just move on. But what about those people that are not just disagreeing with you strongly, but are... they want a pound of flesh. How do you handle that?
Yeah. So I used to not block very many people because I had sort of this thing that if I wanted people to hear me who don't agree with me, I shouldn't block them.
Yeah, you're naive. Go ahead. Anyway,
I was naive and stupid. Yes. And then reality hit me and I was like, they're not listening to me. All they're trying to do is keep other people from listening to me. So I block them. I have no, you know, I mean, I block pretty fast now.
Well, I think Brene Brown said something, I mean, I picked up years ago, or something like that. They haven't earned the right to sit at the table.
Right.
Something like that, she said. Yeah, that was a really good insight.
That is exactly right. You know, they haven't earned that right, and they're not interested in listening. You know, I think I've also done this with some of the reviews that have come out from people who their main goal behind the reviews is to keep other people from reading. Yeah. And I had to make a decision early on, was I going to respond to all these things or was I not? And so it, you know, I decided pretty early on that there's just no point in responding to some of these very bad faith right. responses. You know,
I mean, people see through it anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, so you have to choose who to engage with. And where is going to be the biggest bang for your buck. And I mean that not in a monetary sense, but where can you be heard? And so, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you have done and continue to do to get that message out, to get, just like you said, the impact that your book has had, and also understanding the cost that it's come at to you. And so just again, like Pete said, to applaud you for that. Thank you for bringing it out into the world. And thanks for jumping on the podcast with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want a community, classes, and other great resources, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it always goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show.
You've just made it through another episode of The Bible for Normal People. Don't forget, you can also catch the latest episode of our other show, Faith for Normal People, wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People podcast team. Brittany Prescott, Savannah Locke, Stephanie Spate, Natalie Wyand, Stephen Henning, Tessa Stoltz, Haley Warren, Nick Striegel, and Jessica Schau.
Jared thought we could start with the question, why do you hate men?
Oh my gosh.
I think that's a great question to start with. I've gotten lots of those accusations lately.
The notes say, Jared to give a sincere endorsement with some sass.
Yeah. You need help with the sass part?
Oh yeah, the sass part. That's what I have a hard time with. Not the sincere endorsement.
I think you need help with all this thing.